from yesterday, showing what goes wrong when we try to include massive vector bosons in the theory. I mentioned that we, first of all, violate gauge invariance. Okay, so we show that that is potentially one problem. But the other issue that we're going to discuss now is that when you include a mass for a vector boson in the trivial, most naive way, just by writing down a mass term in the Lagrangian, you run into problems with renormalizability, even though naively you didn't have any sort of non-renormalizable couplings in the theory to begin with. So to make this argument, we had to derive what is the propagator for a massive vector boson. And compared to the photon, there's two changes. First of all, you shift where the pole is. Okay, so I put in a minus ma squared in the denominator here. But the most important change is that you affect also what's in the numerator. By summing over the polarizations, we have this extra piece that goes like k mu k nu over ma squared. So that's the part that will be important. If you're familiar with generalized gauges for gauge theories, this propagator is in a particular gauge known as unitary gauge. But I won't really discuss what that means. So now we're going to see how this affects renormalizability. Remember what happens in QED, where you have a photon, a massless photon. When you start computing loop diagrams, you run into infinities. But in principle, those infinities are not problematic because you can always absorb those infinities into the definitions of the couplings, namely the charge and the mass. So to sort of sketch what happens in QED. So you have divergences in one loop diagrams, for example, such as the electron self-energy or this three-point vertex. The divergences always can be absorbed into the couplings. Just say into the parameters of the Lagrangian. And once you do that, you're free to compute anything, and you will get a finite answer after you've completed this program of renormalization. In massive QED, this is not the case. So now we're going to sketch out a calculation in massive QED, and we'll show that this is not true. So what we're going to consider is the four-point function. So suppose we have two of our fermions just scattering. So let's say we want to compute a scattering diagram at one loop. So the diagram, we'll have lots of diagrams, but in particular, I want to focus just on these box diagrams. So you'll have a diagram like this, where you have two fermions going along like this, and then they'll exchange two of these vector bosons. Okay, we also have to include the tree level one, but that's not too complicated. All right, so suppose we want to compute scattering in one loop. We need to define some momentum going around the loop. So let's call this k. And I just want to look at what happens as k goes to infinity just to figure out, or just to show you that this is, in fact, divergent. OK? So everything I'm going to be describing is somewhat qualitative. So first of all, we have four interactions. And so I'll put the gauge coupling to the fourth power here. Now I have some integral over the loop momentum. And I'm going to regulate this integral using a cutoff. And so let's just say I'm going to do my integral up to some cutoff lambda. Then I'll have to integrate over the loop momenta. And then I just want to think about the powers of k through all of the internal lines in this diagram. So I have two fermion lines. And so I have two fermion propagators. And so qualitatively, that will look like k slash plus m psi over k squared. I'm going to be taking the limit that k goes to infinity because I'm worrying about what happens at the cutoff. So I'm neglecting, you know, powers of mass in the denominator, for example. I could neglect this one too, but you'll see why it'll be important in a second. So that's from one of the fermion lines. I have two fermion lines, so I'll just square that. This is qualitative. Not worrying about how the Dirac indices contract into each other. Now I have two massive vector boson propagators. And I have two terms. Since I'm just worrying about what happens as k goes to infinity, this is obviously the most important term here. So I'll have two powers of k mu nu, or k mu k nu over ma squared, like this. OK, they should be different Lorentz indices, but this is a bit qualitative. All right. So now we can ask, how does this blow up as k, in terms of the cutoff? So here, if I neglect this mass term here, I have k over k squared, so that's a power of 1 over k squared, so that's 1 over k squared. Here I have k squared squared, so that's effectively k to the fourth. And here it would be k cubed dk. So the whole thing, once I integrate it, will go like g to the fourth times the cutoff squared. Effectively, the whole integrand is like integrating dk times k. Okay, so we get cutoff squared. This is just keeping the leading divergent terms in the integral. OK, so there's other diagrams to consider as well. And in particular, we also need to include not just this one diagram, which we just did, but also a diagram here where the photon lines are crossed, the massive photon lines are crossed like this. So if I only think about the behavior as k goes to infinity, it's actually very simple to relate this one to this one. Let me just follow how the loop momentum goes through the loop. So here I'm assuming that k goes around like this. Here, if I have k going this way, then I'll have k going this way, and I have k going this way, and then back up here. So the only difference between these two diagrams, at least as k goes to infinity, is just that in this fermion line, the direction of k will switch. Okay? So in one of these fermion propagators, I'll have minus k instead of k. All right? So because of that, the leading divergence, so this behavior that it goes like cutoff squared, will actually cancel off between these two diagrams. So the so this quadratic divergence cancels off. Then you might ask, can I have a linear divergence? You have a question?
There's a problem in the power counting.
A problem in what?
Power counting.
Power counting. OK, maybe there is. Oh, yeah, there is. I forgot part of the expression. I forgot this part out here up front. And so there should be another factor of 1 over k squared, quantity squared. Thank you. OK, so the quadratic divergence, I argue, will cancel off. You might ask, can I have a log divergence? The answer is no, just due to symmetry. K goes to minus k under the integral. OK? And so I'm left with a leading divergence, which is just logarithmic. So let me also write. No linear divergence is allowed. Based on symmetry. So the leading divergence that is still left over is a log divergence. And that comes when I have the m psi squared term appearing here in the fermion propagator. So the parts with the k slashes won't contribute to the divergence because it'll cancel off between these two terms. And the cross term, where you have a k slash times a mass, will also not contribute. That's the linear divergence, which you're not allowed to have by symmetry. And so the leading term will be this m psi squared part. So the leading divergence goes like g to the fourth times m psi squared times the log of the cutoff. Or you could write it as the cutoff squared. It doesn't really matter. OK, so this divergence will survive. And so I'm left with a divergent expression. And this divergence cannot be reabsorbed into any of the parameters of the Lagrangian. So how do I get rid of this divergence to have a finite calculation for my scattering process? Well, I need to introduce a counter term for the four-point function. So you need to introduce a counter term in the four-point function to absorb this divergence. So you need to write down a term in the Lagrangian which allows you to absorb that contribution in the four-point function. And so that is just simply this expression like this. And it may have particular Dirac structures inside. But the main point I want to make is that you're absorbing this divergence in a dimension 6 operator. This is a non-renormalizable operator. So it's not possible. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that even though we started out with what seemed like a renormalizable theory, secretly it was a non-renormalizable theory because we need to introduce higher dimensional operators in the theory to absorb all of the divergences. So C has mass dimension minus 2. And so this is secretly non-renormalizable. And it's not, the problem just doesn't stop here. It persists for higher order functions, endpoint functions as well. So we would need to introduce a tower of higher dimensional operators. Okay. So that's the problem. Now we're going to show how this problem is fixed through something called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so first I want to discuss sort of in general what it means, spontaneous symmetry breaking. Is this readable? I can't really tell. You see this? It's not really showing up. OK. All right, spontaneous symmetry breaking. So as we showed, if you violate a gauge symmetry explicitly in the Lagrangian by writing down a mass term for the gauge boson, it introduces these problems. But these problems can be avoided through spontaneous symmetry breaking. And the idea is that the symmetry is not broken explicitly in the Lagrangian, but it's broken spontaneously, even though the Lagrangian by itself obeys the gauge symmetry. And the way this works is because the ground state with broken symmetry can have lower energy compared to ground state with unbroken symmetry. So the idea is that the Lagrangian itself obeys the symmetry, but it's the ground state that breaks the symmetry. All right. So let's see a little more about this. So let's say, suppose we have some transformation U. So U corresponds to a symmetry transformation. Between two states, or I should say, it's a symmetry transformation that leaves the Hamiltonian invariant. So we have H, and we act with it with a symmetry transformation as follows. And we get back the original Hamiltonian. OK, so this is what it means to be invariant. So let's have two states, A and B. And they're related to each other by U. So that if I have U acting on my state A, I get state B. OK. So I can express something equivalent in terms of creation and annihilation operators. So I want to define my state A as being the creation operator for state A, acting on the vacuum. And state B is just the creation operator for state B, acting on the vacuum. And the symmetry transformation in terms of the creation operators has to be as follows. So if I take my creation operator for A, and act on it with the symmetry transformation, then I get my creation operator for state B. So now we can see, we can use these relations to prove this in kind of a simple way. So if I have U acting on state A, this is U acting on the creation operator acting on the vacuum. And I can insert the identity in terms of U dagger U, still acting on the vacuum. And so this whole thing is just the creation operator acting on state B. Now I also have to think about how does the symmetry transformation affect the vacuum. Well, if I assume that the vacuum is symmetric under the symmetry transformation, then the vacuum would just be invariant. And so this whole thing here is just the vacuum. And so then I'll get creation operator for state B acting on the vacuum, which is just state B. Okay. But the part I just want to highlight is that this proof relied on the implicit assumption that when I take my symmetry transformation and act on the vacuum, then the vacuum is left invariant. So if this holds, then state A and B have the same energy. For example, I can calculate the energy of state A. State A, so it's the Hamiltonian sandwiched between state A. And since the Hamiltonian's invariant, I could write this as U H u dagger a. Oh, sorry. It's not quite how I wanted to prove it. So state A is related to state B as follows. And so I have state B, U times H, U dagger, state B. So this is just transforming state A into state B using my transformation. And since the Hamiltonian's invariant, this whole thing is just H. So we have the Hamiltonian sandwiched between state B, and that is just the energy of state B. Okay. So what we've proved here is that the spectrum of states, the energy levels, reflect the symmetry, meaning that if I have a transformation that will take A into B, and the Hamiltonian respects the symmetry, then the energy levels for A and B must both be the same. But this proof implicitly also assumed that the vacuum is also invariant. So if we violate that assumption, then the energy levels are no longer going to be the same, even if the creation annihilation operators satisfy the same transformation properties. So let me try to write down what I'm trying to say. So if the ground state preserves the symmetry, then the spectrum of states manifests the symmetry. If the ground state violates the symmetry, then the symmetry is not manifest in the ground, in the spectrum. Okay. So if the ground state violates the symmetry will effectively be hidden. There will no longer be a symmetry transformation between certain states. But there will be remnants of the symmetry in terms of relations between the different parameters in the theory, which we're going to see how that works. Okay. So we're going to start out with a pretty simple theory. We're going to work our way up to the standard model in terms of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So first, we're going to start out with baby steps and consider a very simple theory with a real scalar field. And a Z2 symmetry. Which means that the theory is invariant if I set phi to minus phi. So here's the Lagrangian. I have 1/2 d mu phi squared minus 1/2 mu squared phi squared. Then I have lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. So it's obvious that the theory is invariant under the symmetry. And the symmetry forbids me from writing down any terms that are either linear in phi or cubic in phi. I want to stick to renormalizable theory. Those are the only options I have. Okay. All right. Now I can write down the Hamiltonian for this theory. So I have 1/2 phi dot squared plus 1/2 times the gradient of phi squared plus the potential phi, the potential v of phi, where now the potential is this function, let's see, 1/2 mu squared phi squared plus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. So the question I want to ask is, how do we choose phi in order to minimize the Hamiltonian? This is a question of how do we find the ground state. So first of all, the phi dot term and the gradient term are both squared. So obviously the Hamiltonian is going to be the smallest when phi dot and the gradient of phi are both equal to 0. So we want to take phi to be equal to a constant value. So if we can neglect those two terms, the question of minimizing the Hamiltonian is just a question of how do we minimize the potential. So we just need to look for the minimum of the potential, and that corresponds to the value of phi for the ground state. Okay. So we want to minimize the potential. And so let's think about these couplings here. So lambda, first of all, has to be positive. The reason it has to be positive is if it was negative, then the potential would be unbounded from below, just because the potential would become infinitely negative if we sent phi to infinity or minus infinity. So we're required to have lambda be positive. But the same is not true of mu, or I should say mu squared. Mu squared is the parameter. Mu squared can have either sign. It can be positive or negative. Mu squared you want to think of as a parameter by itself. Okay, so there's two cases to consider. So I'll just sort of draw the potential. So in the case where we have mu squared positive, then close to the origin, it just increases quadratically. And then if I go far enough away, it increases quartically. So okay, just kind of looks something like this. So in this case, okay, it's obvious that the minimum of the potential is at 0. Phi is equal to 0 would correspond to the ground state. So you would write down that the expectation value of the field phi in the ground state would be equal to 0. Now let me sketch the other case. So in the case where mu squared is negative, then as you go away from the origin, it will decrease quadratically. And then eventually, the quartic term will win. So you'll have a situation that looks like this. So now you can tell that the minimum is no longer at 0, but the minimum is either here or here at some non-zero value of the field. And so I'm going to label these points here by a small v. And then by symmetry, this one would be at minus v. So in the ground state, the expectation value of the field would just be equal to v, plus or minus v. This is the case where you have an unbroken symmetry. It's obviously that if the symmetry is still manifest, then this expectation value has to respect the symmetry, meaning that if I flip phi to minus phi, then I have to get the same answer. 0 is the only number I can have on the right-hand side that would still satisfy that. On the other hand, if I'm, let's say, here at this point v, then it's obviously if I flip phi to minus phi, the equation is no longer satisfied anymore. I have not v, but minus v. Okay, so the minimum will be either at one of these two points. All right. So how do we find this point v? Well, we just need to minimize the potential and solve for where the derivative is equal to 0. So I want to take the derivative of the potential with respect to phi, and then set phi equal to this number v. And so that gives me an equation that's mu squared times v plus lambda v cubed is equal to 0. And so solving this, I have v is equal to plus or minus the square root of minus mu squared over lambda. Remember, mu squared itself is negative, so minus mu squared is a positive number. So this quantity v is known as the vacuum expectation value, or VEV, of my field phi. So in the first case where the symmetry is unbroken, the VEV is 0. In the case of a broken symmetry, the VEV is non-zero. Okay, so that's finding the ground state. Now we want to find the spectrum of states, the excitations around the ground state. Those physical states are defined as small excitations around the ground state. So it makes sense to rewrite my Lagrangian not from the point of view of my original field phi, but from the point of view of a shifted value of the field phi with respect to the value of phi at the ground state, v. So we'll define a shifted fields. Which I'll call phi prime, as the following. So I'll just write phi is equal to the value at the ground state plus some small excitation around that value. And so this field phi prime is going to be sort of the quantity that I'm going to quantize eventually. Okay. So here we go. And so now I just need to rewrite my Lagrangian using the shift just by substituting this into what I wrote down before. Okay. So the shift, first of all, is just a constant. So the derivative term, I can just copy. I just have to add a prime. Constant doesn't enter into a derivative. Then I have the potential. And so I should write V of phi prime, like this. And I can expand this out. So I have minus mu squared phi prime squared minus lambda v phi prime cubed minus lambda over 4 phi prime to the fourth. So all I've done here is just take my potential and plug in. Sorry, this is not what I wanted to write here. Plug in for phi v plus phi prime, and then just expand it. There's also a constant, but I won't worry about that. Okay. So this is what you get. Now, the key point is that this Lagrangian does not respect the original symmetry that we started with. And you can see that just because we have a cubic term appearing in the Lagrangian. Cubic term doesn't respect phi prime, goes to minus phi prime. So the original symmetry not respected by phi prime. So in a sense, the symmetry is hidden in this theory. But the symmetry is manifest in the different couplings of all of the terms in the Lagrangian. Remember, we started out with only two couplings in the Lagrangian, lambda and mu squared. Here we have three different couplings in the Lagrangian. We have the mass term, minus mu squared. We have a cubic term, lambda v. And we also have the quartic term proportional to lambda. In a general theory, these three terms would each have independent couplings. They would be three independent numbers. Here, that's not the case. All three of these couplings are defined in terms of the two original numbers that we had. So there's a relationship between the three couplings in the theory in terms of two parameters. So the symmetry is hidden, but it's still reflected. In the relationship between the parameters of the theory. Okay. Now we can also write down what is the mass of the phi prime. It is just equal to, so it's m phi prime squared is minus 2 times mu squared, which is also 2 times lambda v squared. Okay, so take the square root of that. That is the mass of this phi prime field. OK. So now we're going to go through the same exercise for a slightly more complicated symmetry. Instead of having discrete symmetry, we're going to think about an abelian symmetry, a global symmetry, not a gauge symmetry. So let's say we have a complex scalar phi and the Lagrangian, the most general renormalizable Lagrangian, would be would have a kinetic term. And then there would be a term like this, mu squared phi dagger phi minus lambda phi dagger phi squared. So here is the quadratic term, and here is the quartic term. And it's invariant under a global U1 transformation. So phi goes to e to the I alpha times phi, where lambda is just a constant. Here I've sort of flipped the sign of mu squared compared to what I had before. Now I'm going to assume that this mu squared is a positive number, which means that spontaneous symmetry breaking is going to occur. So from now on, those are the only cases I'm going to consider. So we'll assume e squared is positive, so that we get spontaneous symmetry breaking. So let me write down the potential. So I have minus e squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. In order to find the vacuum expectation value of phi, I want to minimize this potential. So let me take the derivative and that's minus mu squared phi, or I can write it like this, minus mu squared plus lambda phi dagger phi, and all of this is proportional to phi dagger. So, obviously, I have a maximum where phi is equal to 0, but I have a minimum when what's in the parentheses here is equal to 0. And so that tells me that the magnitude of phi has to be the square root of mu squared over 2 times lambda. So this is the value of phi corresponding to the ground state. And I want to define this to be v over square root 2. The square root 2 is just a convention. So I'm just factoring out a factor of square root 2 compared to what I wrote down before. So let me sketch what v looks like. So now I have two degrees of freedom corresponding to the real part of phi and the imaginary part of phi. So there's a maximum at the origin. Then as I go away from the origin, the potential decreases. If I go in the real direction, and it's the same in the imaginary direction. So the potential kind of looks like this. It looks like the bottom of a wine bottle. And it's minimized at any point where the magnitude is equal to this particular value. So this defines a circle in the real and imaginary plane for phi. So there's an infinite number of degenerate minima. Any point along the circle is fine. And you can see that all of these points are related to each other just by the symmetry transformation. The symmetry transformation just goes around in a circle, so that's why I have a circle. So What we want to do now is define our shifted theory. So let's write as follows. We'll write phi is equal to phi 1 plus I phi 2 over square root 2. So phi 1 and phi 2 are just the real and imaginary parts of phi. So one thing that we're free to do because of the symmetry is we're free to choose whichever point we want to pick as our vacuum expectation value. Okay, so I'm free to pick one particular point along this circle just because they're all related to each other by the symmetry. If I pick a different point, well, I can just get back to my original point by the symmetry without any loss of generality. So I'm going to assume, without any loss of generality, that only phi 1 gets a VEV. So that means that the expectation value of phi 1 will be equal to this quantity v over square root 2, and the expectation value of phi 2 will just be equal to 0. So I'm just picking one particular point here, which I guess is just here. So now what I want to do is define my Lagrangian in terms of a field which is shifted with respect to this vacuum expectation value. So we'll expand the Lagrangian in terms of the shifted fields. So we'll define a new field phi prime, phi 1 prime. This and then phi, oh, sorry. Phi 1 will just be equal to v plus phi 1 prime, and phi 2 will just be equal to phi 2 prime. So field 2 is obviously not getting shifted because there's no VEV for phi 2. So now I can just plug this into my original Lagrangian. So let me just write out what you have. So I have 1 half e mu phi 1 prime squared plus 1 half e mu phi 2 prime squared. I have minus mu squared phi 1 prime squared plus lambda times v phi 1 prime times phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared. And then the quartic terms are lambda over 4 phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared, quantity squared. OK, so I just basically divided it up into the quadratic, cubic, and quartic terms in the Lagrangian. Once you expand everything out in terms of these shifted fields. So now we can look at what the masses are for my shifted fields. So m phi 1 prime squared is just 2 times mu squared. But m phi 2 prime squared would be equal to 0. You can see in the Lagrangian that there's no mass term for phi 2 prime. The reason for this, you can see from the potential. If I'm here at the minimum, the phi 2 direction corresponds to going either into the plane, into the board or out of the board. At that point, it's along the circle itself. There's no energy cost to going in that direction just because the potential is flat in that direction. There's no energy cost to move around the minimum. So this is a symptom of a general result known as Goldstone's theorem. Goldstone's theorem tells you that if you have a symmetry that's broken, there is one massless boson known as a Goldstone boson for every generator that is corresponding to a broken symmetry. So let me just write this down. For every broken global symmetry, or let me just write it like this. For every broken continuous symmetry, there is one massless boson per generator that is no longer a symmetry. In this case, it was pretty simple. We just had U1. U1 only has one generator. So we get one massless boson, one Goldstone boson. Okay. All right, so that was the case of a global U1 symmetry. Next, we're going to discuss the case of a local U1 symmetry. And this is the sort of the problematic case that we wanted to consider originally. What happens if you have a gauge boson with a mass? And so here will be a model that will give exactly that. And so this model is called the abelian Higgs model. And so the ingredients will be a complex scalar, phi, with a local U1 gauge symmetry. So it's exactly the same model, just now we have a local symmetry and not a global symmetry. Here's a Lagrangian. We have a covariant derivative of phi. We have a mass term minus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And then we just need the gauge kinetic part, 1/4 f mu nu, f mu nu. Okay, so the covariant derivative is just the regular derivative plus I times the gauge coupling times the gauge field. And the field strength tensor is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So next, we have to consider that the theory has spontaneous symmetry breaking because we want to minimize the potential. The potential is exactly the same as what we had before. in the global case. So it has exactly the same minimum. So potential V of phi is minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda over 4 phi dagger phi squared. And so it has a minimum where the magnitude of phi is equal to the square root of mu squared over 2 lambda. And just like before, I'm going to call this V over the square root of 2. And now I'm just going to expand the Lagrangian exactly the same way as we did before. So I'll write phi, which was phi 1 plus I phi 2 over the square root of 2. I'm going to define it in terms of the shifted fields. So I'll write this as V plus phi 1 prime plus I phi 2 prime over square root 2. So now I just need to plug this into the Lagrangian and expand it, and you'll see the magic happen. The new feature of this theory compared to the old theory is just the covariant derivative term. You'll see how that will play an important role. So let's look at the covariant derivative term. So that is d mu phi squared. And so I'm just going to expand this one term. So I have my covariant derivative, which acts on my new fields, which I have up there, V plus phi 1 prime plus I phi 2 prime over the square root of 2. All of that is squared. So now I'm just going to expand all of these things out. So I have, so I get a 1 half from the square root of 2 squared. And first I have the derivative terms. I have d mu phi 1 prime plus I d mu phi 2 prime. Next, I have so that's the derivative acting on all of this stuff. Now I have the gauge field acting on all of this stuff. I have I g a mu times v. I have I g a mu times phi 1 prime. Then I have minus should be a minus g a mu phi 2 prime, and all of that is squared. So, I have a lot of terms. Let's expand out some of them. So first of all, this term squared will give me the kinetic term for phi 1 prime. This term will give me the kinetic term for phi 2 prime. I'll have a kind of a cross term where this multiplies either one of those two terms. G V A mu D mu phi 2 prime. The term where it multiplies phi 1 will end up canceling off when you take the absolute value, because there'll be an extra factor of I in front. And then I have a 1 half from this term squared. I have 1 half g squared v squared a mu a mu. And so those are all of the quadratic terms. And so everything that's left is terms that are cubic and quartic in all of the fields. OK. And so the important thing to note, first of all, is that here we have a mass term for the gauge boson. And so so that's what we wanted to get in our theory. So we have a massive gauge boson. And its mass is just given by g squared times v squared. So this is the essential ingredient of spontaneous symmetry breaking. We didn't write down an explicit mass term in our original Lagrangian. But what we did is, because the potential and the Hamiltonian are minimized due to a non-zero value of our field phi, it generates a mass term spontaneously, just simply through the fact that the ground state doesn't obey the symmetry transformation, is not invariant under the symmetry transformations anymore. OK. So that's the main point for today. Tomorrow, we're going to look at this extra term here. And so this sort of looks like a mixing term between the gauge field and the kinetic parts of the phi 2 field. And so we're going to show tomorrow how we can get rid of that extra term and what that implies about the theory. That's all.